This is Agent Carlisle Wilkinson. It appears more episodes of this strange podcast, purporting itself to be NetSurfer Pro, have been discovered. Whether these have always existed or recently appeared is unclear. It does, in fact, have terrible SEO. Regardless, as neither host seems to exist, I have filed to temporarily classify this as SCP-T-103123. We will be investigating it and its origin shortly. So far, other than its anomalous origin, its primary anomalous trait is the insistence that it is still October 2023, despite currently being November 2024. More to follow.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for web. Computer today.
Computer.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
Welcome back to NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride to the World Wide Web. I am, of course, your host, Galen.
And I'm your also host, Matthew Marissa. And isn't it NetSpooky Crow? Was that what we called it?
It was Net Spooky Boo, something like that.
Spooky Boo. It's still Spooky Month, and as such, we're still talking about something very spooky. So I hope you have a nice blanket to wrap yourself in because you're gonna get the chills. Yeah. So last time we were talking about a little thing known as the Antimimetics Division. This is where you go, huh?
Yeah. I was thinking about going like, oh, what is that? I've never heard of it. That's a joke that everyone would make, clearly.
Okay, yeah.
Do you think that people in the Antimimetics Division have office banter about it and everybody else hates it?
Mm-hmm, definitely. Everybody's like, first day on the job. When it's like somebody they've known for years. So, we talked about the Antimimetics Division and the original storyline. However, years later, Quantum, the original author, QNTM, came back with a new sequel story, a part two, which was released in, I believe, 2017. And this is 5x5x5x5x5.
Yeah, 5x5x5x5.
Yeah. And before we get into that, though, there's a few things I wanted to touch on that I either missed or need to correct in previous episodes. One of which is that there is sort of a meme in the SCP community that is just the phrase, there is no canon. I think we talked a lot about the canon of the SCP wiki, which doesn't really exist because it's a collaborative effort. In Quantum's writing has its own, like, separate canon, unique to Quantum. But there's other Antimimetics Division work that's not attributed to Quantum that other people have done. And that isn't necessarily the same canon, per se, as what Quantum has written. And Quantum having written things is not the same canon as other stuff that came before their work. And so when mentioning Ojai, which, by the way, I was corrected, it's Ojai, California. I'll probably still end up saying Ojai on accident, so excuse me. Ojai being written first as like a completely separate thing that then became part of the Antimimetics Division sort of retroactively. The difference between the time setting of the original and Quantum's version can just be explained as there being no canon.
Yeah.
Also, I want to shout out that like this has even appeared in SCPs themselves, of course. There is an Antimimetic SCP that is like a Civil War canon that can only be perceived for about 5 seconds, and afterwards, people think there's nothing in the room that it's in, so there is no canon. And then also, the author Placeholder McDoctorate created a story about the Raise No Canon, which is like a particle canon that sends your brain back in time. And, of course, this causes a paradox that causes the Raise No Canon to get never built. There is no canon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep. It's also kind of fun because there is no canon is sort of a fun way to handwave different interpretations. Like, I can disagree with the way people personify 2747, but neither their take or mine are canon.
Yeah.
And so, like, I think as a mantra, it kind of helps community togetherness, because sometimes I am guilty of this too, of like trying to enforce one reading of a very intentionally vague work. I think like Pets Cop, in some regards, I feel like I might have been too harsh on some readings of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think the Petscop community as a whole was constantly having to be reminded by each other, hey, there's more than one reading, it's fine. And I think with the SCP wiki, that's also the case.
I would contend that there is about as much canon to the SCP wiki as there is canon to the Bible. Do you know how many versions of the Bible there are?
Oh, yeah.
At least three.
At least three.
And maybe they have more.
And they have different acronyms. Or sorry, initialisms.
Yeah. Thank you for respecting my religion. Yeah, like, there is sort of a kind of through line of canon. There is something there. However, what is there is incredibly case by case. And, you know, one person could very well make an entire second Anti-Mimetics Division story that has absolutely nothing to do with Quantums and is exactly as valid as Quantums.
Yeah. You know, what's kind of fun about this is that, in a way, a lot of the concepts of cosmic horror negate the concept of canon by, like, not having a true form or a form that is incomprehensible. It's kind of impossible for there to be a canonical form.
Yeah.
You know, what's a good example? Like, I mean, you could say Cthulhu, but like Nyarlathotep, or who's the guy that dreams everything?
Mario.
Yeah, Mario. Kind of like how there's no canonical way to interpret Mario, so he can appear however you wish.
Damn it, Mario would have been much better reference. I should have just... Hang on, you can just delete the whole Bible thing. We don't actually need that part, right?
Oh yeah, sure, we can get rid of that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
The SCP Foundation is kind of like Mario.
Yeah. And so, like, in a way, by, like, not having a canonical, for example, appearance of 3125, it both allows people to try to imagine what 3125 is, but it also does mean that, like, no interpretation is correct. It is that far outside of knowing.
I feel like another aspect of this is that in the SCP Foundation history, one of the only pieces of, like, one of the few pieces that is, like, definitely true, no matter who you're talking to.
True no matter who.
Is that the world has ended at least multiple times.
And we have staved more than once.
Like, at least more than once, and we have staved it off or reset the world or done something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that also kind of adds to, like, any individual canon. The canon where the SCP Foundation ends up trying to kill everybody. The canon where the Anti-Mimetics Division story happens. Any individual one of those very well could have happened and just gotten erased from history. Which the Anti-Mimetics Division story itself really ties into. Really, really plays with. We'll get to that later. But, like, I feel like the SCP wiki has a very good time with both having canon and not, because of the fact that, like, if a story was, like, threatening enough or deep lore enough, it could just have been something that did happen but we're fine now, or it did happen but we hit the big reset button. It's great. It's a wonderful storytelling beat. It's a wonderful way for SCP writers to tell, like, you know, extremely high lore details and extremely, like, gross and horrifying stories because it's canon.
It's canon and it isn't canon.
It's like a superposition of canon. A super canon,
a quantum position.
Oh! Hey,
that's the guy's username. It's not even related to the stories. There are two other addendums I wanted to make, one of which is for our first episode from this month. I wanted to say this because this is information I wasn't fully aware of until while making the notes for this episode, and I wouldn't feel right without mentioning it, but I mentioned one of the repeating characters in the older series of SCPs, Dr. Bright, has been more or less hard retired from ever appearing on the site. And that's because the admin, the person in real life, Dr. Bright, that was their username, who is responsible for the character, was apparently, like, completely removed from the site and any positions on it due to being found to have groomed minors.
Well, that's unfortunate.
It's unfortunate. I felt like I wanted to make sure I brought that up on the podcast. Otherwise, I would feel bad about not mentioning it.
Yeah, we wouldn't be doing our due diligence.
Exactly. On a more brighter note, I guess just to wrap, to catch you back up into the story so far, the first part of Anti-Mimetics Division was about a unit in the Foundation that fights things that are hard to remember or will destroy your mind if you know about it. All of these turn out to be connected to a single SCP, SCP-3125, and the site's director, the director of Site-41, who is Marion Wheeler, thinks she has a way to stop it. However, through like trying to stop it, she causes an outbreak of SCP-3125, dooming the entire anti-memetics division and forcing her to set off their on-site warhead. I wanted to note, though, that the final chapter of part one is called Case Colorless Green. For one thing, I saw a video saying that there is such a thing as like a green light that's higher than what humans can perceive. I don't know if that's actually true or not, so I like tried looking it up, but looking up green light is impossible to like find any meaningful thing for, so I didn't like keep looking. However, colorless green is actually a reference to the famous Noam Chomsky line.
Okay.
Colorless green ideas sleep furiously.
Yes, yes. It is a, thank you, CJ the X, for teaching me this one. It is a sentence that is technically grammatically correct, but says nothing.
Yeah. It doesn't just say nothing. It's like counter to comprehension.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean colorless green? What do you mean green ideas? What do you mean sleep furiously? Like, every part of it is contradictory to itself, but you can't say it's not a real sentence.
Yeah.
I think it implies sort of a distinction between the meaning of words and their grammatical case, that you can have, like, poor grammar and valid meaning, because grammar itself does not convey meaning, but it still kind of does, because something having an adjective or an adverb or a verb still implies something. Like, an idea sleeping still means something, even if we can't tell what it is.
I also think that, like, I like the idea that it is a case colorless green is kind of like code red, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, the ideas have awoken furiously, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I also think that the idea of, like, a sentence that is structurally sound but meaningless also is a very good reference to make in the anti-memetics division, considering, as I mentioned before, the idea of the anti-memetics division itself being a division that places puzzle pieces such that while you can't see the puzzle piece that you're trying to observe, you can see everything around it to get the shape of it. Like, it's, you know, it's something that is the shape of a sentence, even if the contents of the sentence are meaningless.
Yes. And it also has very important reference in that point to something we'll get to much later. But first, we have to go to an intermission. And I don't mean our podcast has to go to an intermission. I mean, if you want to grab like a snack or something, feel free.
Yeah, grab a snack and a glass of orange juice and try not to reach through the screen, because here we go.
Yes, try not to reach through the screen. That would be very spooky. Please do not reach through the screen. Oh god, there's a hand.
Oh god. My goodness.
All right, so first we have SCP-2256, which are very tall animals. I kind of interpret them as just giraffes.
Yeah, they're a class of, like, dinosaur, or at the very least, like, megafauna, that are, like, really, really long, giraffe-y. Like, they have very flat feet that helps them, like, balance on water despite being so massive.
Which is kind of like the Dali elephants, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
What is notable about them is that they are anti-memetic.
Yes, I don't know if it was... Well, no. In the very end of the first half of Anti-Memetics Division, we get the idea that there are animals that have natural anti-memetic camouflage,
mm-hmm.
which is a very interesting, like, continuation of the idea that, like, an anti-meme is not just a supernatural thing, it is a biological process that some animals have adapted to.
Yeah. It's a fun way of viewing evolution in terms of, like, the adaptations and things that animals do to survive. There's just a chance that one of them would have evolved a natural anti-mimetic camouflage, much in the way that animals will have natural environmental camouflage.
Yeah. However, SCP-2256 is an animal that does not like to be recorded, essentially. Mm-hmm. So they have anti-mimetic properties, and the early pages of the paragraph describe that, like, they actually have a long history with a culture, I think it was like a Polynesian culture,
mm-hmm.
and they were revered, they had like a name that was something like the ones who walk in silence, and they're described as like very harmless, lovely creatures, except the first attempted photograph of one of them literally killed it.
Yeah.
When the Foundation tried to just snap a photograph of one, it died. And it is believed, as the article goes on, that attempting to record it and attempting to, you know, view it actually has negative effects, which is probably why they developed the anti-mimetic camouflage. But the fact that we live in a world that is more and more and more being recorded, and, you know, like, there is just a larger complex of memetics, means that they are dying out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we get the interesting part of the article. So, we've mentioned before that the SCP Foundation likes to block texts out. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to take the marker and destroy things. The article begins to pepper in a lot of the blackout texts, but it tells you just enough to make you understand that information, videos, photos, writings about these animals deteriorate at a staggering rate, such that, like, it is probably a natural process of their antimimetics properties, but it's not just that recording them kills them and harms them, it's that what you then have as a record itself is going to deteriorate. And as you try to read more and more of the article gets blocked out to where you're only reading a couple sentences at a time. But the, like, very final sentences essentially get across the idea that, like, all information of these creatures, like, there was a last one that was dead. This is an extinct species. And the last parts of the article give you the idea that all records of these creatures may cease to exist within, like, 3 to 7 years.
It's a very heart-wrenching and kind of beautiful in a somber way take on the environmental sort of messaging around extinction.
Yeah, it's like, it's a very lovely bottle story because it describes creatures that are pretty unequivocally harmless, benign, if not, you know, outright kind of great. They have cultural history, they have cultural relevance, they've been around about as long as us. But because of humans' actions, because of the world that humans have created, they could not fit in that world anymore. And indeed, because of, you know, a little bit because of the Foundation's actions as well, they could not exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just slowly died out. And not only are we going to lose them, not only have we lost the dodo, let's say, we are also losing any knowledge that we have of them. Yeah. We are losing them from our history.
Yeah, it's scary how, like, you think about these old periods, you know, the Carnivorous, was that it? Different, like, periods in history, the Cambrian era, the Jurassic and Triassic periods, the Cretaceous period. Like, there's so many plants and animals that were alive once and are no longer alive that we also just don't have a record of.
Yeah.
Or barely any record of. And that's kind of, it's scary to think about that there are also animals today that are going extinct and will soon meet that same fate unless we do something about them. And I think it's just told really well as an intermission here because in a way it reflects where SCP-3125 is taking humans.
Yeah.
But also it is just itself a very fine standalone story that has very clear environmental themes. It's nice.
Yeah, it's really well written.
Now on to SCP-3125. Now you might be thinking, wait a minute, didn't we already talk about that? Well, sort of. So this SCP-3125, it has the typical article that Marion Wheeler had read at the end of the previous part, or no, the start of the one before that, where it's like, it's contained within this facility in Site-41, and the Site-41 director must visit it every month. However, there is a keypad at the bottom that you can actually click on to enter a code. If you input, well, the correct code is 55555, which you might have expected by the series chapter title name being 55555.
Yeah.
But if you put in the wrong code, you get this symbol that kind of looks like the Leo symbol, but not quite. It's Unicode symbol 3125.
Ah.
So that's fun. And I want to, again, remind you that 3125 is 5 to the power of 5, or 5 times 5 times 5 times 5 times 5.
Yeah. It's like a very easy way to remember it is that there are 5 reallys in the Hunter Girlfriends who really, 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 really love you. Mm-hmm. And there are 5 fives in 3125.
Yeah. So the new part that you unlock by putting in the correct code is that it just continues stating that 3125 is a hazard from a plane above the noosphere, the sphere of all knowable human knowledge, that intersects with our plane, and it is conscious, and when you think about it, it sees you and kills you and anyone in your, like, vicinity conceptually, your coworkers, your friends, your family. The reason it gives is that SCP-3125 is a, like, theta-dimensional fractal, and the theta symbol links to SCP-33, which, mentioned in the previous episode, is an older, like, pre-anti-memetics division anti-meme SCP that is, like, a mathematical symbol that's not in our number system.
Yeah.
That makes math implode whenever it's included or written down in an equation. Just like that, this one, it's sort of the way it's described is that 3125 is an idea so complicated that it, like, terminates thought. It causes, like, a memory leak.
Yeah.
Or it's, like, garbage data. The brain can't contain it and doesn't know what to do with it, so it implodes. I think comparing 3125's, like, kill method to 33, which has been established already, is very clever. I also think, so, it describes a possible end-of-the-world scenario. And what's interesting is, so, the end-of-the-world scenario described is that 3125 essentially takes over people, makes it impossible to perceive them as human, and then controls them and makes them only able to think about 3125. I commented on how the meme and anti-meme dichotomy is really convoluted and blurry throughout this series, but I think the concept is that 3125 is essentially making humans forget how to be human. It makes them forget everything except 3125. So it is less that 3125 is hard to think about or hard to remember, and more that it makes literally everything else hard to remember.
Yeah.
A inverse anti-meme, much like the inverse anti-meme containment chamber. I also like that there's a note about the weapon that Bart Hughes had proposed to build to stop this, but it couldn't be built due to, like, a lack of resources, which means it couldn't be built because of bureaucracy. God damn it. And then addendum 3 at the very bottom is, like, a very sweet one. It kind of says, like, you tried to fight this and you couldn't win, but the person I know could have. The person I know would never have given up, and I'm going to do the same.
Yeah, so to clarify, there is an addendum 2, which I don't believe was there in the...
Right, like, and that previously. That was Marion Wheeler saying, like, this is what I'm going to do, much like the process that was done with the Mr. Gray victims.
Yeah, she's like, I have an idea, I don't think it's going to work, I'm fairly certain that this is the end of all of us, here we go. And then we get the addendum 3, which is the really nice note of, I knew a Marion once a while ago, and she was, you know, she did not easily give up, as you seem to have, but I'm not really here to tell you your business either. The world's kind of gone to hell on my end as well.
Yeah. And it's written by Adam.
Adam Wheeler?
So, now we get a meet cute in Fresh Hell. This is told from the perspective of Wheeler. Adam Wheeler. I kind of love it because, like, it says, like, something about Wheeler shaking off these, like, disembodied hands and fingers. And then it uses he. And then it's like, oh, this is Adam we're following.
Yeah.
It kind of uses the last name Wheeler to play a little trick on you.
Yeah.
And then it mentions Hutchinson in the next paragraph. And it's like, right, that was her maiden name. And so we're getting the story of how they met. Aww. Aww. They met in a hospital that was being overrun by fingers.
Yeah.
SCP named Finger. Yeah, so these aren't just, like, fingers bitten off of hands, but it's like bodies get turned into a mass of crawling fingers, kind of like worms or maggots.
Yeah.
As explained on the article.
Adam ends up calling it digitization.
Which is funny.
Yeah, yeah, which Marion, like, literally later comments, like, digitization, like, to become digits. That's kind of clever.
Yeah, there's a bit where Marion has a gun and she thinks to herself, like, I really wish I had, like, a something wider, like a grenade or a fire axe. And then, like, as they're trying to escape, Adam sees something and grabs it off the wall and hands it to Marion. And it's like, you look like you could use a fire axe.
Yeah.
And so it's so sweet. He got her a gift. Just what she wanted. How thoughtful. There's also a nice bit about how, like, Adam is constantly almost going to, like, freak out and throw up. But Marion starts asking him about his job, what he does. He plays the violin professionally. He offers to play some Bach for her when they get out. It turns out that this is SCP-4051. It has been in this hospital they're in for a while, and it's taken over pretty much an entire building of the hospital, but nobody has realized it, because the anti-mimetic effect has extended around the hospital building.
Yeah.
And Adam even explains that, like, he was there just because he, like, twisted his ankle, and he was in the emergency room, and there were a ton of people with missing fingers from various freak accidents. I always love, in horror writing, when freak accidents are part of a pattern.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like they're part of a pattern, but they are. So, like, it's sort of a planned, or a Close Encounters of the Third Kind, or Jacob's Ladder, or Signs sort of thing. You know? Just things keep happening, but it turns out they're happening for a purpose, even if it's not visible.
Yeah, even if it's not obvious. It's also here where we kind of get the core character, not the core conceit of Adam, but like one of the core things that sets Adam apart in general is similar to what sets Marion apart, which is that he's part of the like low percentage of people who can very naturally see anti-memes and see anti-mimetic things.
He has like the highest natural anti-mimetic resistance in the world. Whereas Marion, like, has to actually use Nestix, Adam doesn't really have to.
Yeah.
For most of the
There's a time. there's a lot of times throughout the story, we're not going to dwell on it every time, but there's a lot of times throughout the story where Adam, like, clearly can see things that a normal person should not have been able to. And so it's, you know, it's really interesting, ultimately, and it kind of... It's good storytelling, basically, that, like, the guy who ends up marrying the chairman of the anti-mimetics division is a guy who himself is very good at seeing anti-memes.
Yeah, and he's very resistant to anestics.
Yes.
There is a bit where Adam compares what's going on in anti-memes in general to Fnords. This took me down a huge rabbit hole. So Fnords are a concept from a, like, fake internet religion. I say fake, and it's sort of like the Church of the Subgenius.
Yeah.
It is sort of like a not serious cult, but a more modern religion based on older, usually connected to like sci-fi or fantasy writers. Instead of it being a serious cult where you have to pay $100 to get a book, cough cough, it's more of just like a fan base.
Yeah.
Sort of a self-sustaining religion that doesn't take itself seriously enough to be like have churches or have stuff like that. But you know what makes a religion valid is a very complicated thing. You could also compare it to like Satanism, for example.
Yeah,
but Satanism is a bit more coherent and widespread than this.
I was going to compare it to Pastafarianism, actually.
Yeah, kind of like Pastafarianism, but that's also kind of different, and they're similar, but this is more about the theory than about the practice, whereas a lot of Pastafarianism and Satanism is about kind of using religious exemption laws.
Yeah.
Or like using it as a counter-protest to religion. In some ways, this isn't. Anyways, it's called Discordianism. It's a religion that worships the goddess of discord, and the goddess of discord is opposed to the goddess of order. And this is the term Fnord is supposedly a like word that I don't remember if the word Fnord is in this like religious text or if it's in the Illuminatus, which is a trilogy of fiction books about conspiracy theories that references Discordianism. But in the trilogy of fiction books, Illuminatus, I have to repeat, it's fiction. The word Fnord is like a word that people are trained not to recognize when they see it and cause discomfort and unease when it's read. And like, so any media that has the word Fnord on it makes you unhappy, uncomfortable. And it's like newspapers have Fnord.
Yeah.
Billboards don't have Fnord because things that want to sell you things don't want to make you uneasy.
Yeah.
It's like a mind control thing you can't see, but affects you subconsciously. It's sort of fun in a meta way of looking at things like the word choice in newspapers and how that affects what you how you react to information.
It sounds, might just be on the mind, but it sounds kind of like a Library of Babel thing where like it's a literary thought experiment of like, What if there was a word that made you just discomfortable seeing it?
I mean, kind of. It's used in, like, this fictional conspiracy theory tied to this religion that is, you know, more or less fictional religion. But, like, I mean, yeah, it's fiction, so it is a literary device, and it's more satirical in that it does represent something else.
Yeah.
Not fully... I don't really say it's much like the Library of Babylon. The concept of this Discordian religion is... often compared to Bokenism from Cat's Cradle.
Ah.
In just sort of concept, and they reference Bokenism in the book that started Discordianism.
Bokenism?
Either way, Fnord is essentially a proto-version of an anti-meme as used in the Anti-Mimetics Division. And I like to take this as sort of a nod by Quantum to inspirations.
Yeah.
I could definitely see Quantum writing on the SCP wiki, having been familiar with this sort of niche internet subculture thing.
Yeah.
It's also apparently used as a tone indicator in, like, old IRC and Usenet chats, which is very funny.
Yeah. Slash Circe, slash J, slash Fnord.
Exactly. So they get out of the hospital, they get rescued by helicopter. And there's a bit of them talking about X-Files and how much they hate it. And Marion says, like, she hates the will they, won't they. Usually you know if you will when you see someone. And Adam's like, do you? And Marion's like, yeah, I think you do. So that's a fun.
That's cute.
They have great chemistry.
Yeah.
And that's why in the next one, Marion puts a gun to Adam's head.
Yeah.
Marion comes home and she's like, who's in my house? And she tackles Adam, puts a gun and is like, don't move, don't say anything. Brings him into questioning. And Adam's like, I'm her husband.
Yeah. So, like, the chapter, the next chapter is Where Have You Been All My Life? Which itself is, I'm fairly certain, the line from, like, the 50s song, the Fallout song.
You know, that
song. It turns out that she has forgotten her husband. And, like, when he finds out, he goes like, ah. I see it finally happened. If you recall from the previous one, Marion has an SCP, SCP-4987, who is trained.
As opposed to J-987, J-985.
Yeah, of course. It is a trained SCP that eats memories off of her. Apparently she, like, usually does trivia and stuff to kind of, like, feed it. But now it has eaten the husband. It has eaten the fact that she was ever married. And so she kind of, like, does business as usual, more or less. She, like, locks him up, does a lot of interrogation, talks to, you know, a lot of her people. And she's like, hey, so is this guy, like, legit? And they're like, yeah. No, yeah, he is. The records all check out. And I do, in fact, remember him.
I had a conversation with him, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, all these other people in the Foundation know Adam. And I want to note, by the way, so Marion herself doesn't do the questioning because she's worried about having, like, a connection. And Adam, from Adam's perspective, it shows, like, the amount of questions he goes through is, like, torturous.
Yeah.
It seems more like they're trying to break him down to coax some sort of confession out of him. Or they're just keep forgetting that they've already interrogated him.
Yeah.
It's unclear which one it is. But there are a few SCPs that really do a good job at highlighting how bad containment is. I think this is a thread that appears, like, every few years, or, like, at least once or twice a series being the thousands mark, that, like, from the perspective of an average person, being contained by the SCP Foundation is torturous. I mainly bring this up just so I can shout out SCP-8980, which is a recent one that is all about this line of thinking and is heartbreaking and is one of the saddest things I've ever read.
Nice.
It came out recently. It's called Ergophobia. It's if you are familiar with it, you will know exactly what I mean. It's heartbreaking. All right. So anyways, there's a bit where Adam talking to Marion says, there are names you mention and then stop mentioning. And don't react when I bring them up, which sort of implies that Adam's resistance to anti-mimetics leaves him with more info than Marion.
Yeah, I love that.
Marion doesn't react when he brings up these names because she is being forced to not react. She cannot perceive them.
Yeah.
And also, I want to note that Adam brings up, like, you're fighting a war and you've almost won. And Marion says, what war? Meaning, part of 3125's defenses is that even if people are actively aware of this thing, it is able to make them forget they're fighting it, which is kind of a wild thing to have a defense system that is, even if you try to fight me, you'll forget you're fighting me. Obviously, there's like the 3125 bunker that can't be accessed and can't take things out of. So like, in a way, she never knew that she was fighting this thing. She just knows that there's something in the bunker, but like, otherwise she doesn't know about the war because that's how 3125 kills. But even then, like, it feels really convenient for 3125 in some ways that the only way Marion knows about the war is when she goes into this one room.
Yeah.
Anyways, so it's kind of 4987 attacks Adam again, and he gets like engulfed in the light that 4987 is, this like light in Marion's eye.
Very specifically, 4987 attacks him because Marion comes to the realization that like 4987 made her forget her husband. She has trained 4987 to not act without her will.
Yeah.
Which means that it had to do it for some reason. And she kind of surmises, like, I think it's trying to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think that it did this randomly. It didn't just make me forget my husband for no reason. It did it because we are all in danger, which means that the most safe thing that you can do is not know who I am.
4987 was a good boy this whole time.
Yeah.
It was just trying to keep Adam safe. And it attacks again, erases the memory of Adam, erases Adam's memories, rather. And Marion's like, take care of him. He was never here. I'm going to remove my memories. Get on it.
Yeah.
Essentially.
I never had a husband.
None of this ever happened. Yeah. Remove the marriage. Make him forget everything. And now we go on to Ojai, which is pronounced Ojai. So this is kind of a fun thing. It's a log of someone sort of, what's the word? Like invading a house that is reported to have essentially a person of interest inside.
It's oh God.
It's
yeah,
called the Green Site because green is the name they have given to the code name they have for this problem. And the leader's code name is Red. I want to talk about this a bit because this is a super interesting symbol. We have case colorless green, of course. But you could think of colorblindness as a form of anti-mimeticism, of something being unable to be perceived, in this case, the difference between red and green. Even then, the way certain anti-mimetic things are described is mostly by vision, and there are colors that humans can see that other animals can't, but there's also colors other animals can see that humans can't.
Yeah.
And using color to represent in this case, I think, is really interesting because, like, we can't really picture half the colors that a mantis shrimp can see. Does that mean they're outside of the new sphere? Does that mean they are anti-mimetic and only certain animals can view them?
Does that mean that mantis shrimp have their own new sphere?
The mantis sphere?
The mantis sphere?
I summon mantis sphere in attack mode. Yeah. Additionally, so here's a fun thing that I did get when I looked up green light you can't see. Have you heard of the color red-green?
No.
So red and green are opposing colors in the visible light sense of, like, cones and rods.
Yes.
It is normally impossible to get a green that is also red, a color that is both red and green at the same time, because they kind of cancel each other out.
Yeah.
Similarly, blue and yellow do this too. But there have been experiments to make people essentially view red and green at the same time by, like, crossing their eyes or using mirrors to overlap them to create red-green. How effective this is hard to say. There's a whole rabbit hole of impossible colors and, like, optical illusions to make things look weird and, like, hard to find, just in the way that, like, the brain contorts things. But I think it's also really interesting to think about this because the process of seeing red and green at the same time is more or less a brain process compressing information into a viewable thing.
Yeah.
And this is interesting when you think about the Class Z nestics that make it impossible to forget. Marion Wheeler, when she took or will take Class Z nestics in Case Colorless Green, might have forgotten how to isolate red and green, and thus she might be able to see red-green.
Interesting.
That is sort of a scientific example of what it means for our brain to filter out that information normally.
Yeah.
And what remembering constantly might have actually been like.
Oh, that's a really interesting pull.
So this guy goes into this house. It's a fucking gamer nest. Yeah. It's Asmongold.
literally Asmongold's house. Yeah, the guy that he's like, the main character here is like an agent of the SCP Foundation, like probably a member of like the Mobile Task Force or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, he does this no-knock warrant on the dingy house where a guy is doing a stream, and the stream is, you know, it's meant to be like, all right, so, you know, do a slice here and a slice there, and you can summon the weird creepy thing, yeah, on your own.
And remember to say
Yeah. Remember to hobble and subscribe.
There, also, note that the mirrors in the house are painted black.
Yeah.
Black mirror.
Oh my god. What if there was an idea, right? But every time you look away from it, you've forgot about it. Wouldn't that be fucked up?
Charlie, are you talking about the entrance to our writer's room? Where have you been?
What if your dad left to get milk, but he didn't come back? Wouldn't that be fucked up?
Charlie, is your accent changing? You kind of broke into Australian there.
What if there was a guy who started from Australia but become South African? Wouldn't that be fucked up?
Charlie, we don't have time for you. We've started a new series. It's not called Black Mirror anymore. It's called Red Door.
Now show yourself to the Red Door.
Kicks him out. Yeah. So, that aside, I think a streamer cult is a very funny modernization of the Ojai Church.
Yeah.
A lot of the points behind the Ojai Church don't work as well in a day where Scientology is less prominent. It still exists, but, like, it's not the subject on everyone's mind like it was when 1425, was that the original, was written. And so adapting the concept for a new day and age and it being a streamer cult is kind of great.
Yeah.
It's kind of brilliant.
Really good.
Yeah. So, and it's even shown that, like, the soldier mentions later on that they expected something like this to be a vector for 3125 to spread. And so they already had plans in case something like this happens. They saw live streaming and they're like, somebody's going to start a cult.
Yeah, someone's going to try and do some shit.
Yeah.
So the agent, the MTF guy, whoever he is, like, more or less knocks out the kid and he puts a visor to his head that, like, shows him.
It's a gun with a circle on it that has a big spiral and it shows a spiraling shape. Like the They Might Be Giant song, Spiraling Shape.
So he like plays this, you know, this hypno video.
Mm-hmm, pretty much.
And
it's a blue and red hypno video, by the way. So it doesn't have green.
It's greenless.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, you know, kind of takes a seat and he explains, we kind of expected something like this. And we developed our own counter meme because, like, if a meme takes over your mind, then we just need to take over your mind with a different, much more harmless one. And then stop it before it destroys your mind?
Yeah. I wanted to say, first off, so he gets into a whole fight scene with this, like, streamer teenager, or, like, 20-year-old who's been possessed, essentially. They get into a fight scene, it's pretty detailed, and then, like, the agent tackles the kid, binds him in, like, a chokehold, and it says, like, there's some haphazard kicking, less choreographed, which is very funny to describe the more, like, flailing fighting as less choreographed.
Yeah.
Like, you just didn't want to write it, but at the same time, that's a very apt descriptor.
Yeah.
It's very self-aware. Also, the agent says that this kid, this person, is being controlled like a finger puppet. Finger.
Finger.
Finger. Finger. Think about fingers. Finger. So yeah, he sits down and he's like, we gave you mind chemo. You've been possessed. We're going to get the idea out by making you only think about the spiraling shape. I don't even remember if that's how the song goes.
However,
it didn't work.
It doesn't work. Didn't work. It turns out that the boy was, like, too far gone, I think.
He willingly gave himself over to 3125.
Yeah.
Which, you know, lonely gamer kids in lonely, dark buildings and
giving themselves dirty rooms. Yeah, giving themselves over to extremist ideologies, perish the thought.
Pretty interesting. This was written in 2017, mind you. He's alive and he does an exorcist spin, like a head spin.
Yeah.
And he's like, you couldn't kill me, I can kill you, and kills him. There's a bit where, like, He makes the agent forget that he has hands, and so he doesn't think to pick up the gun he had dropped because he doesn't think he can.
Yeah.
He forgot what hands are.
However, the agent does have the wherewithal as he realizes that, oh, I fucked up and I'm about to die. He does call in, like, the orbital strike equivalent.
Yeah, the orbital laser.
Which is like an anti-mimetic orbital laser that like will destroy just the meme. He like says fire. He says like Epsilon 3 hut hut hike fire, and then SCP-3125, or you know, the kid who is overrun by it, kills the agent. And it says like nothing happens, but I don't know if it is implying that like, and it says, like, and then there was nothing or something like that.
I think and then there was nothing is supposed to be the laser struck.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm fairly certain the idea is that, like, it sort of wipes the, you know, wipes the place from existence, or wipes the agent of 3125 from existence rather than, and, you know, it didn't work. It's also noted that the agent specifically, like, argued to not just kill the kid. He put himself into this situation by trying to save the kid. Which is just a little extra, you know, dollop of tragedy on top of it, of course. SCP has a very good tragic writing.
Oh, wait, no, it does say, but nothing else happens. Huh.
Ah, so maybe it didn't actually work.
Huh. I totally thought it did kill the kid, and the agent, and everyone. There's a bit where, like, 3125, or Red, as it's just called in the passage, scours through the agent's mind, finds, like, the Foundation, the Overseers, and finds the Mobile Task Force outside, waiting for the call that won't come. Once again, the person going into the dangerous situation forgot that they have a Mobile Task Force.
Yeah.
It's similar to the lake where Marion didn't think to bring a Mobile Task Force. This time, this guy did, but also just forgot about it.
Yeah, he couldn't call them in because he did not remember they existed.
He forgore skull emoji. Yeah. Next we have In Memoriam, which is about a memorial. To what? Well, Eli, who is a new recruit, I believe a new recruit and not a first day.
Yeah.
Recruit.
No, she is very specifically mentioned as like a newer recruit.
Yeah.
Also, is her name Eli?
Yeah, it doesn't have two L's. It has one L and one I.
Ah.
And an E, of course, at the start. Eli is like, hey, there's this big fucking thing in the behind the site. And Marion's like, yeah. You want to go look at it?
Yeah. Marion's like, well, clear my schedule. Want to go have a chat?
Yeah. Also, note that on her schedule is to visit the 3125 containment unit, meaning this might be the same day as when shit happens.
Yeah.
So they go to the memorial. It's in the woods behind Site 41. They don't really know how to get there, but they get there eventually. And it turns out it's a huge monolith that you can go inside and go up a whole bunch of stairs. They say it's like 91 meter by 91 meter by 145 meter.
Yeah.
It's fucking massive. And when they're inside,
I think it's like 9 kilometer by 9 kilometer.
Maybe
like,
even. Like, yeah. Yeah.
But
they go up a staircase around the monument. Eli notices writing on the walls. But it's not really writing. It's kind of just etched boxes. And Marion says, they're tombstones. But it shows an example of one of these, and it's a bunch of redacted boxes.
Yeah, it's like somebody put one redacted box, space, one redacted box, space, etc., etc.
Yeah, which is so interesting because Marion views them as tombstones, but they could have text in them. Isn't that fucked up?
Yeah.
Isn't that wild? And Eli even reads text. Something about, we thought we were a powerful civilization.
Yeah.
And Marion's like, huh? And Eli's like, nothing.
One of the fun things about the chapter is that, like, it really endears you to Eli because Marion essentially explains a little bit, but more or less is kind of like, well, you tell me. And so a large part of it is Eli, like, piecing things together herself. It's, you know, Marion gives her the tools she needs, but Eli is the one who eventually figures out the purpose.
Yeah. I want to note that in, I want to say, okay, so actually, they get to the top of the monument and they stare out into the distance. There's a whole bunch of like reading equipment there, stuff that the Foundation might have used to like study this, but they don't really do much with it. Marion just looks off into the distance. She mentions that there are 40 people in the anti-mimetics division, but in a previous chapter, I want to say, in Where Have You Been My Whole Life, somebody mentions there's 125.
Yeah.
Meaning that more people have gone and probably been forgotten. But through this whole process, Marion explains finally that this is a monument that was not only constructed, but is entirely memoranda. It's in memoriam of an old ancient civilization that was probably way more complex than what humans are nowadays, because Eli mentions, like, this was a whole chunk of basalt that was picked up, moved here, and then carved out, like, entirely.
Yeah, it's non-native rock. Or at least, like, you know, not native anywhere 500 kilometers yeah. away.
But the size of it means that they would have had to move it anyways then.
Exactly.
They couldn't carve it out of the mountain they're on. And so Marion keeps going, explains about the society, mentions that there are some, like, ruins and cities you can find that are also affected by anti-mimetic means. Whoever these were, like, were around for a long time, had their own version of the anti-mimetics division, and also fell prey to whatever it is we're fighting. Keep in mind the invisible ancient society.
Yeah.
And then Eli sees something off in the distance.
Yeah, there's a gigantic figure.
A big gray spider. A spider!
A spider!
A spider! And on its back
is a guy.
A guy in his 20s with disheveled hair who says, "Hey, Marion, this is for what happened at the lake."
Yeah, notably has two gunshot wounds. It turns out it's the fucking...
It's Lynn Marnus.
Yeah, it's Lynn Marnus probably being puppeted by 3125.
Oh, definitely being puppeted by 3125. Which eats Eli.
Yeah, it fucking consumes Eli, and Marion essentially has a thought of, like, hang on, I've just learned a lot of information from, like, I've learned that I have met this thing before, I've learned that it has a vendetta against me, but she also is like, what would I ever write down to myself so I don't forget this?
Yeah.
And then it turns out, she doesn't really have time.
She has to book it back down the stairs.
It turns out Eli's sacrifice was entirely in vain.
Yeah.
And the very last sentence is her walking out, just like casual as a fucking duck, and being like, well, it looks like it's time to go visit 3125's chamber.
Yeah. She couldn't remember what had just happened in the monument because of that anti-mimetic field around it.
Yeah.
And she even mentions that to Eli, like, as soon as we leave here, we're going to forget all about this thing. It's very tragic, the idea that a memorial, which itself is made to remember people, can be forgotten.
Yeah.
Kind of defeats the purpose of the memorial in some way. And it's also tragic just because, like, the people listed mean something.
Yeah.
The words and the language used mean something, but it's gone.
It's also really tragic because we just introduced a whole ass new guy to fucking die, tragically.
And she was great.
Yeah, she was great. I loved Eli.
Eli's great. We stan Eli.
We stan Eli.
Rip Eli. Hey, this is post-production Matthew Marissa. So it turns out this episode is very long, and it was getting to the point where I wasn't going to have it ready for like another month practically. So, in honor of Half-Life 2's 20th anniversary, I guess, we're doing a Anti-Mimetics Division Part 2, Episode 1, to be followed by Anti-Mimetics Division Part 2, Episode 2. For now, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want to see us cover next or things you think we might like. And you can also find us on Twitter at NetSurferPro or on Blue Sky at NetSurferPro.bsky.social. Follow us on there for more updates on delays or what have you. See you.